Welcome to Tales from the Bridge. This is episode 61, and we are talking about Salvation by Peter F. Hamilton. We pretty much all really like this book. Next week, we're talking about film and television, Andor, Avatar, definitely stuff to talk about with that one. We're going to have some film recommendations for some classic sci-fi films. All right, Kevin's got some science news for us. Let's make our way over to the bridge.
So for science fiction, science fact, I need to talk to you guys about fusion, because of course fusion's come into the news once again, and it seems to be very mainstream right now. A concept that was really nerdy a week and a half ago is suddenly front page of CNN. And I was like, what? Why? Because we've been talking about fusion off and on, and it seems like an exciting source of energy, and it's a possibility for us to do really cool things and decarbonify our energy sources. And suddenly we have like Secretary of Energy in the United States getting all excited. And as far as I can tell, and I don't really understand a ton about fusion, but as far as I can tell, it's an incremental improvement over what we've had before, but it's kind of an exciting incremental improvement. Do you guys know what's going on with this fusion thing?
Oh yeah. 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 Well, it's a significant barrier that has been broken, because it's the first time that the fusion reaction has actually produced more energy from fusion than you've actually put in, and this is important though, from the laser's power that you're pumping into the fusion reaction. So they pumped in 2 megajoules and they got out 3, and it's the first time that the reaction's broken even, right? Always every other kind of fusion, this kind of fusion, it's been less. But there is this rather important caveat that it cost 300 megajoules of energy to power the laser, and then the laser put in, you know, 2 megajoules, and we got out 3 megajoules. So we're still only getting out, you know, 1% of the actual amount of energy that was fed into the whole machine. So that's what they call wall power, like if you plug this into the wall. So it's still a long way to like build an energy generating plant. But from the fundamental physics point of view, we now have actually, you know, created a vessel, right, where just into the vessel, what you're pumping in is less than what you're getting out, which means the fusion reaction is like actually happening and it's scalable. And hopefully, you know, with all these other engineering improvements, we can make this more efficient to actually produce more energy than we're putting in.
Because I remember hearing about these new fancy lasers maybe a couple years ago. And I remember somebody saying that the implications for fusion were legion. So the opportunity to be able to do whatever it is that they're doing with these lasers, was a big deal. And they've turned this around in fairly short order. Like, I think it's only been a couple years since they've modified to use these new types of lasers. And I don't know what they are, but it seems like this has actually happened fairly quickly. Right, like this is a new type of laser technology, and it's totally different technology from what they're using in Europe. Right, at the ITAR fusion, they're trying to use something a different type of technology.
Yeah, that's a tokamak. So that's like a plasma, a low density plasma, basically that they're heating up and trying to contain in a magnetic field enough to like spark fusion. That's more like creating a miniature sun. The what this is called is inertial confinement fusion, and that's the laser thing. And actually, I think there's another subtlety here. From my understanding, is like the National Ignition Laboratory that created this thing in the States, they're actually still using actually really old lasers. They're using these ancient lasers that were made in the 80s. And the whole facility, I mean, this is the laser is the size of 3 football fields.
Whoa.
And that's pumping this. And that's all that energy is going into something about a millimeter in diameter, the actual fusion pellet. So there's a lot of, but you know, that whole facility has been built over like 20 or 30 years, and like efficiency of the laser was not the priority at the time, right? They're focusing on just making it happen at the target and whatever power they need to put in. But there is huge advances in lasers that now some private companies that are starting for making fusion power are trying to sort of leapfrog, you know, over where this project is at by actually using all the modern laser stuff, which I guess is much more powerful and efficient and all that sort of thing. But they haven't built like, you know, the whole thing yet to see how it works. But apparently there's a lot of places where the efficiencies just, you know, the big research projects haven't been focusing on making it more efficient and all that kind of stuff. They've just been focusing on the fundamental physics. And they're also like making pellets that are they're made of diamond so that they can be, and they have the tritium fuel inside somehow. And they're made of diamond so they can be transparent, so they can actually take pictures of like what's going on inside. So like everything here is designed to be a physics experiment to actually study the physics. All of the design parameters have not been optimized to actually like make a self, like energy generating plant. So the thinking is that now that they've proven that it's possible fundamentally, physically, you know, now all these companies and investment and government and, you know, can sort of accelerate and be like, okay, it's possible, let's go. And so they can work on many different fronts of making the lasers more efficient, the targets more efficient, the fuel more efficient, to actually put together something that, that works. And I've always been of the opinion that it's fusion or bust, baby. Like, we're dead meat unless we make fusion work. It's the only clean and high energy density form of energy that I think we can get. Solar's fine and wind is fine, but you're never going to like power a you know, steel refinery off of that. You just don't have the energy density that mm-hmm. you need. And I mean, without huge developments in batteries, and then you're wasting all this time and energy and materials and manufacturing, creating batteries to try to like up the voltage and up the like wind and solar. They're just not going to cut it for like powering an actual global or, you know, interstellar civilization. And unless we get fusion going, like, it's just, we're not going to have the energy to do what we need to do. And once you do have fusion, the thing about it, it's not emitting carbon. So you can use that energy to suck carbon out of the atmosphere without actually adding to the problem. And I think, you know, that's the fundamental barrier we got to cross.
And the fuel's hydrogen, right? Like, that all it needs is hydrogen for this thing, for inputs?
Well, yes and no. They're isotopes of hydrogen, unfortunately. So it's not hydrogen. It's deuterium and tritium. Mm. So hydrogen has one proton and one electron. Deuterium has one proton and one neutron inside the nucleus and still an electron. And then tritium has two neutrons and a proton. And those are actually, that's another part of the problem. Those are not easy to generate. You actually have to invest a fair bit of energy and stuff to like in new, other kinds of nuclear reactors to create tritium. You can't just go like mine tritium. But there are other fuels available. So helium-3 is another possibility. And actually, this is, what is it, in E&M Banks, right? Mm-hmm. They're always mining, they're scooping helium-3 from the gas giants or something to power their fusion. So there are various ways, but basically you need a light element, two light elements that you blast together, and they make slightly heavier elements, and those are not radioactive, so that's really great. Mm. But they're still kind of exotic fuels. It's not like you can just do this with seawater or something.
Oh, that's too bad. Yeah. I was hoping for that.
So would there be like in the near term, probably it still generates a level of waste and then you sort of work your way out of it? Is that sort of the idea?
The waste is always pretty well. Yeah, no, the waste, as far as I understand, it'll be different depending on what you're bashing together. But the waste is always something pretty benign. It's like helium, like the waste from this particular reaction with tritium is just helium. And hey, helium's like as benign as it comes. You might get like boron or lithium or something, still very light elements, but they're not radioactive. They're not like these monster wacky nuclei that are with long decay times that you get out of fission. These things really are quite benign. You do get a lot of neutrons though. So like at the site of the reaction, they create a lot of like neutrons that fly out, and those are dangerous, but you can shield against those. You just put up some lead and maybe like the container itself for the fusion reaction over time will become radioactive from absorbing all these extra neutrons. But like the actual products of the reaction are not radioactive the way uranium, plutonium and stuff do.
What are some of the sort of bleeding edge, awesome things that could come out of this, say 10, 20, 25 years down the road? Like what, where does your imagination take you on fusion?
Ever wondered what it takes to make it in the movie business? Peel back the curtain with 4-6 Success Filmmaking. 4-6 Success Filmmaking is where filmmakers share their stories and the secrets.
It's beyond competitive out there.
There have been movies that it's taken me 10 years to get made.
Don't wait to create. Like, you've got to just keep making stuff.
Tune in to 4-6 Success Filmmaking for your dose of cinematic realness, direct from the voices that have lived it.
Who, me?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, in my science fiction story, I think it's all about miniaturization. Like, I think cold fusion is still a real possibility in the world. I don't think we need to make, you know, miniature suns. I think it's all about developing something that acts like a nuclear enzyme, right? Just like enzymes catalyze chemical reactions that wouldn't happen on their own. I think the way to go is like miniature devices that have like, you know, microfluidic channels that just have like a few atoms of tritium flying at each other, and then the right catalyst to just like make them bash or hold them in the right orientation to like make the reaction happen. So, I mean, my science fiction future would be kind of like solid state devices, like semiconductor chips and stuff, right? But they're just fantastic, enormous energy sources that can just power whatever the hell, right? Like, it's like mini fusion batteries is, I guess, what I'm saying, like miniaturized fusion batteries. That's what I think is like the science fiction future of this. And then you just slap that onto whatever device, wherever you need it to power, you know, anything, suits, gloves, goggles, houses. You know, it's sort of like, instead of making some giant mega $1 trillion generator, you know, centralized to generate energy for everybody, if we can like decentralize fusion and miniaturize fusion, I think that would be tremendous.
A nice fusion generator sitting in the back of your house.
Yeah, yeah. Or like in your pocket, right? Like in your cell phone.
You know? Right. Little mini suns. Or not, can make it colder.
Can it blow up? I think that's my first, maybe that's every listener's first question who's as naive as I am.
Like the fusion generator plant kind of thing?
Yeah.
I think it can blow up. But not in the same way. I think it's still intrinsically safer. Like if it blows up, it's not going to like spew radioactive contaminants into the atmosphere, right? It's not like a poisoning kind of blowing up. You're concentrating a lot of energy in a small place. So I imagine, you know, there are ways for that to blow up, but it'd be like blowing up a regular coal plant or, you know, something going wrong in a water boiler.
And I guess the other side of it is that we haven't mentioned is that the waste that comes out of it, you know, it's not 10,000 years of dangerous radioactive crud, right? We don't have to try to find places right in the Canadian Shield to bury it. As you said, it's just like helium and energy, and not even horrendously radioactive. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. I think we'll probably see like a hybrid phase too, where a fission nuclear fission plant will provide the energy to like power the laser that makes the fusion plant work, right? And then you feed the fusion energy back to sort of run the fission plant, but you sort of bleed off and take the extra energy that it produces. I mean, I think there's just a lot of trial and error and you know, different kinds of machines to cobble together to make this work.
All right, folks, let's talk about the book we read last month. This was my pick. This was Peter F. Hamilton's Salvation book, 2018, the first book in a trilogy. And, of course, Peter F. Hamilton is a very famous science fiction author who we've never read as a group. And I felt like we needed to read at least something by Peter F. Hamilton. It's space opera. It's different types of technology. There's excitement, there's aliens, you know, it's got a little bit of everything that you need if you're going to have some type of a good space opera. So I figured I would throw it to you guys. My only concern with giving you guys this book was that it really is just the first part of a trilogy. And so reading the first book in isolation, I was a little bit worried about doing that. I don't know how else I could introduce you guys to it otherwise. But anyway, for those who haven't read it, it's Peter F. Hamilton has written other books that also include a certain type of technology, which is portal technology, where it's cheap and efficient to be able to entangle two portals anywhere within the universe to be able to instantly travel through space. And so that opens the doors to interstellar travel very efficiently. In his other series, he did interstellar train networks that would go, you could get on a train in one world and it would come out in another world and it would go very quickly around. And in this world, they use it for transporting energy. So they would put one portal in kind of the corona of the sun, and then they could then transport that heat energy anywhere else in the solar system. So it just kind of opens the doors to really neat concepts. Anyway, so I introduced this book, Salvation, to the group, and I'm looking forward to hearing what you guys have to say. So tell me what you think of it.
Yeah, sure. Space operas, man. I dig a space opera, so this was right in my wheelhouse. And this is a space opera I found is like so grand in scope that because, you know, each chapter is an independent part of the story, you feel like you're reading a collection of short stories, right? Like, and because each chapter is sort of an isolated piece of the narrative that connects to a much broader timeline, and it stretches, and this timeline stretches for hundreds of years, it could be, it was, I found it challenging at times to connect the overarching narratives together. Luckily, for the most part, the key characters are the same, and that helps the reader track the broader storyline. But there were times where I felt like I was reading a separate book and I forgot, you know, as you get into a chapter, it's like, oh yeah, this comes to an end and now I'm at a new part of the story. So, and I don't mean that as a criticism. I really didn't always mind that. And it was always interesting. I think it's important though, for anyone coming into this to understand that they're reading a grand setup. And that's what I hope anyways. For me, a truly great space opera will spend the first book setting the stage. And I think that's what was happening here, as Kevin sort of alluded to. And to achieve that, to set that stage and keep the reader engaged, is a hard thing to do. And I would say that Peter Hamilton mostly managed it here. And so I'm definitely looking forward to reading the next installment for sure. There are sections, or there are teases to what happens in the future with these characters that I'm really sort of keen to find out about. Like, I left really sort of keen, but there's like, it's a lot of little murder mysteries almost. Like, there's lots of little stories within the big story. So it is a giant sandwich. And it was good. It was fine. I enjoyed it. I recommend it. But yeah, it's like a double club sandwich with some fries added on top. And you have to eat it the same time as you're eating a donut. That's how it describes.
You ain't seen nothing yet. That meal that you were eating gets even more complex. So as you get into Salvation Lost and Saints of Salvation, the other two books, it just the grand scope increases on these epic proportions, which is part of the reason why I really like Peter F. Hamilton is yeah, it's an epic meal. You're eating a lot of stuff when you're reading this books.
I had fun with it. I think it does feel like a bit of, but there's also a bit of, like, in terms of style, I maybe always focus too much on style, but I did find that, like, there, you could tell, you could almost pick out that it was the era that it was written in. You could pick out, like, I think it was written in the 90s, right? Like, and you can kind of sense that.
It's recent. No, it's recent. Yeah, it was to 2018. It's the author. That's Peter F. Hamilton. That's his style. Yeah, for sure.
I felt like I had like one foot in the 90s and then a foot in a sort of, like, you know, you could see where it had inspired, I think, like, but it did feel like to me, like, it definitely had, there's some throwback in the style. And but it kind of, you could see some sort of threads of it in what's the space opera I'm always harping on about? It was the TV show,
The Expanse.
Like, you could see the influence that,
for sure, yeah.
Just a little bit. You could see that, like, it's not like, I'm not saying anything was lifted, but like you could see how this sort of influenced or had influence on later space operas, I would say. Anyways, that's my take on it. I would recommend it.
So I did read this a little while ago, and because Kevin recommended it, I started to read the second one in the Salvation Sequence series, if anyone's wondering. So this is book one. So I started book two, Salvation Lost. I'm listening to it, and I did listen to Salvation, and it's great that way for me, because of it being big and having lots going on. The narrator's interesting as well.
Do it.
Like, well, I'm not sure if I can. It depends on when exactly.
I would say it was not super close, but it was definitely almost British.
But listening to it's really good. I do like the second one a lot more. Like I said, I'm not finished yet, but Salvation was a great book that I wanted to read more of right away. I hear what Sam's saying. It's like this mix. It had this, I really liked the story where we're the young people who crash. The thing is with Hamilton, I haven't read much of him, but he is sophisticated. Like something about his writing is very smart. It's like, this is sophisticated science fiction. It's a space opera, but not in a super fun space opera kind of way that I often think about. Like, it's not a space fantasy, even though, yeah, I mean, you could arguably say, of course it is. It's not. It feels like science fiction. Like, you can't mix. I mean, think about Adrian Tchaikovsky's Shards of Earth or the Final Architecture series. Space opera, but fun. And there's a different adventure and fantasy to a lot of the space operas lately. And Hamilton keeps it like, this is science fiction. I can't wait to read more. You guys have spoken about the Void series. I forget exactly what they are, but The Dreaming Void. I have a copy of that and I'm waiting to get into that shortly. I think you guys spoke about that series many episodes ago, maybe over a year ago. But I'd like to read more. I hear that's fantastic, so I can't wait for that. But Salvation, I did get a little bit bored, I got to say. Did get a little bit bored at times when it felt like that detective story of just, it was kind of a whodunit, and it was like he went there and talked to them. But it got a little bit, so we're just a detective. This is like a gumshoe kind of space story here. I wanted to hear better. I shouldn't say better. I wanted to hear the different stories more. And Salvation Lost, the second book, is doing that a lot more. So I'm super happy with that. So if you like Salvation, you're going to love going further into the story because it's great.
I agree. I mean, for the first book is really just a stepping stone into the rest of the series. For me, and I'll talk about this a bit more, but the whole, this was a gateway to the last 40% of Saints of Salvation, the last book. The last 40% of that, I think of that book more than I think of most science fiction books because it was just epic and really cool. By the way, just the narrator, his name is John Lee, and he is a prolific narrator. He's done, I think, all of Peter F. Hamilton's or very almost all of his books. He has also done a significant proportion of Alistair Reynolds' books. Nice. And I just searched on Audible and he's done over 590 audiobooks. So he is a prolific narrator. And he does accents well, right? He does a lot of different accents and I actually have been listening to an Alistair Reynolds book right now, and I'm confused. I keep thinking it's a Peter F. Hamilton book because of John Lee narrating the story.
Oh, that's interesting, yeah.
Well, I got to say, the John Lee's accents have saved me. I also listened to this book in the car exclusively in 20 to 40-minute snippets, and I love Peter F. Hamilton. I like his other books better than this. It's not my favorite. I would definitely recommend the Commonwealth series before this one and the Dreaming Void series. But that is, again, because I've only read the first book, a little bit of the second book just to clear my palate. And I agree with you, Sam. It's like a collection of short stories, and I felt like that. And I'm glad you warned us about this, Kevin, right? That I knew, okay, this is an introduction. It's going to be a world building and stage setting exercise, but it was a little more of that than I was ready to swallow some days. Like, there's like, oh, here's a 5-hour chapter on this particular guy's backstory. And then you jump to something else and something else. And I do find it hard listening to books that are, jumping between stories. I get lost. I lose track of the characters. I lose track of the timeline. I don't see, I need to see the date and be able to flip back to it. Like, where are we here? Oh, this is 2281 or something, right? And this one, and this is, this is probably the most widely separated, in time stories that I've ever seen in one place, right? There's like a future story with a, further in the future of the same character story, and then like an ultra future story, like that we don't even know how far past this it is, that are all sort of interrelated And yeah, it was a little tricky for me to just maintain interest because of that, because I liked some of the characters better and I wanted more of that story, but I didn't really want to go back to, like, you know, 4 hours of this guy's story and that guy's story. But what I did like about it was, like you said, this is why we like Peter F. Hamilton. It's epic. It's epic in a way like probably no other book we've talked about so far is epic. And boy, it was time for that. I gotta say, like, it was really nice to do some big ass, you know, far future, high tech space opera, you know, kind of romp. And that was very satisfying. I was like, ah, right. This is why I read all this guy's books. I do miss this kind of thing. And Peter F. Hamilton, you know, he's got some ingredients that he's been using since the 90s, the gates, right? And I like that. That's also a main element of Hyperion by Dan Simmons that creates a certain kind of world. And I think, honestly, it's the only kind of world that I see as plausible. I mean, I don't know if Stargates are plausible. It's totally like a fantasy element. We have no reason to believe we can create wormholes, really. But we're not going to get as far out science fiction future without them, as far as I'm concerned. If we got to get on a ship to travel slower than light, that, like, it's, you know, we're never going to have an intergalactic civilization or interstellar civilization that way. But with these gates, it's like the perfect ingredient for creating an exciting science fiction world, because boom, you can be everywhere, you can do everything, you got energy, you got waste disposal. I really like that element. Mm-hmm. You know, he just keeps exploring new consequences of the Stargate, basically, right? And this was a cool one, like, oh, we just ship all our garbage through the Stargate.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know, I like that element, but he's been using that since the Commonwealth Saga in the 90s. And the other element, though, that is in the Commonwealth Saga, again, like a core element of his writing, is this infiltrating alien, right? Like the sort of alien enemy that has the power to look like humans and infiltrate our corridors of government and power. And that's just been a constant element in all of his writing that he does really well. And it's here again. And I was like, oh, here we are. Okay, great. Except now he's got two different alien species kind of involved, at least in sort of, you know, being able to mimic humans and insert alien brains into human bodies, and like, that's all great. So I was happy to use this as a stepping stone to the rest of the series, and I'm looking forward to the rest of it.
Yeah, good. Well, I mean, that is right. Like, the first book was this character development of these very important characters, Yuri, Callum, Kandera, Alik, and Jessica. That's right. We learn in the first book that it progresses, and we don't understand how. And so it just leaves you on this cliffhanger where you want to figure out how the pieces are put together. And so this is a gentleman who knows how to get readers wanting to continue to read to buy the next book. He's a professional author, and he does a good job of that. You know, I, in the last month, even though I've read the whole series, I got through all three books. Granted, I listened to them, and I listened to them on 1.3 time or 1.4 time. So I was listening to them faster. And I did skip through some of the, especially Yuri's backstory, the whodunit, because I felt like I didn't need all of that. But I had listened to it before. But I did not skip anything in Salvation Lost and Saints of Salvation, the second and third book. And in fact, for the second half of the third book, I slowed it down to regular speed because I didn't want to miss anything. It's that good. It's an excellent final book. At least I thought it was. And I do sometimes see things with rose-colored glasses, but very entertaining. The epicness comes out in the first book, but it's really later in the series where I start to shake my head and say, holy macaroni, those are some interesting kinds of concepts that he plays with. So highly recommend. Thanks for indulging me on this one. I don't know if we need to do another Peter F. Hamilton. I think we've got a good sense of him through this book. You're right, though. It is very similar in many ways to his Commonwealth books. I don't like the characters as much. The characters aren't as associatable. I don't want to be them. I don't necessarily like them that much. You know, Callum is kind of an agreeable character, is relatable, but apart from them, I'm not sure that I really enjoy them that much. They're great characters, don't get me wrong, but not super associatable. I can't associate with them.
We are passing it to you, my friend. The big moment has come. It's been a long time since we've had the next book. So what's it going to be?
So, I don't know yet. No, nice. I know. I want to have fun. I want to read something that's easy to read. And I'm going to go into the, again, just like Salvation here, I'm going to go jump into the second book because I've read the first. So I think you guys might even be able to catch up and do the whole trilogy if you can, because we're reading We Are Legion, We Are Bob by Dennis E. Taylor.
Woohoo!
Now, boom. All right. Great. Yeah.
So I think
I wanted to read this one.
So have you read this, Kevin?
Nope, I haven't.
Okay. So Marty has read the first or listened to the first, right?
Listen to it, yeah. And it's a great audiobook specifically, too. Great,
now, and,
great.
And I have to say, I'm kind of doing this for Sam because I really feel like this is going to be one that's going to you're really going to enjoy because it's a nice romp. It's super fun. It really reminds me, and now this could be like what you just said about the narration, the audiobook, because I did listen to the same narrator as Project Hail Mary.
Ah, right. Yeah,
that's a great narrator, but
Ray Porter. And so I think this is going to be fun. There's tons of Star Trek references and just other pop culture references, which kind of help it move along. I've only read the first one. There's definitely a story that's coming out of these other two. I think there's just two other books, but there's a definitely
three.
He said there are three others. There's four?
Yeah, I see there's a Bobivorce number four. Yeah, Heaven's River, which just came out in 2020. Well, I got it right in here. I'll just tell you. So We Are Legion, We Are Bob is the first. We Are Four, We Are Many is Bobivorce number two. All These Worlds is Bobivorce number three. And Heaven's River is Bobivorce number four. And Bobivorce is the best universe name ever. I love that.
Yeah. Totally. I'm sold on the title. Sorry to interrupt.
Something, you're gonna love this, Sam. This is like I love this for being funny. Like he's as funny or more funny even than John Scalzi, I'd say.
Nice. Yeah.
Also, like I wasn't, to be honest, and I said this is for you, Sam, because I wasn't sure how you were gonna take Peter F. Hamilton. With his writing style, and I know you want to go on a fun romp. So either way, it's time to do this series or this book. That they're not that long, so we might be able to get through the series.
If I can serve to keep things light and shallow, I'm happy to be that conduit. Sam's looking bored. We got to throw something fun his way. I'm in. I appreciate it.
And you're sort of playing like preemptive defense against the Marty choice, right? Which is going to be another Octavia Butler or some like really grim post-apocalyptic philosophical thing.
Well, Tristan, we must be on the same wavelength because I was trying to download this book the day before yesterday, and I couldn't get it from the library, and I was trying to get it from Audible, but I didn't have a credit yet. So this is amazing timing. I'm happy about this pick.
Awesome. Yeah, it's very, very fun. One thing I wanted to say that's really interesting about Dennis E. Taylor is this is a self-published book. It is still a self-published book. The only time it's been published by someone other than Dennis himself is Audible.
And I have one more thing. I just went to his Wikipedia page, and I'm happy to discover he's a Canadian novelist and former computer programmer, known for his large-scale hard science fiction stories exploring the interaction between artificial intelligence and the human condition. Good for him. Yeah, and I love that he just made it himself, man. Good for him. And then
very cool.
Yeah, I think he's one of the most popular like Audible books.
It'll be a fun one.
That's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great one.
I think my favorite character is Riker.
Right.
From Star Trek?
Not really. No. Well,
so not to give too much away, but it's one guy's brain who gets uploaded into a spaceship and sent in space into von Neumann machines, and so he keeps creating more of himself, and it's the same guy, but they're all under different conditions, and so they diverge right into different characters that started as the same person, and so to distinguish them, that he gives himself different names, and so there's Riker, and you know, he just it's great. It's a really interesting. I mean, it's neat that I've never. There's a lot of ideas in there that when you hear them, you're like, oh, right, I can't believe I haven't read this 1,000 times already in other books.
I feel like this is a good evening read. I'm not going to listen to it, and I'm almost certainly going to be eating gummies while I take this in. I feel like this is a perfect, good, chill, fun, nice, edible kind of book.
Nice. Yeah, I won't be listening. I'll be reading this one too. Because
not audible. You heard correctly. It's an edible book.
Nice. Well, in anticipation of our next episode, where we'll be talking about what we're watching, Andor is going to feature pretty heavily in that conversation. And to that end, that is the theme of our trivia for tonight. And so I hope you've done your Andor research and study. I'll try to start off easy and then work into sort of some fun stuff. And there is some really interesting fun stuff with this show. And so it was I actually came up with this trivia on my own. It wasn't hard to come up with. And there's lots on the internet for this as well. So to get us off started.
Just remember, I have a really bad delay, so I probably won.
First question. So what happens when you die on Ferrix?
They put you into a brick. They put your ashes into a brick.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. Kevin's on the board.
Oh, yeah.
That's a great idea. All right, can I just say that when I was watching the finale of Andor, the music was so extraordinary. I called my children down and I said, "Children, at my funeral, this is the music I want you to play." And it's the finale of Andor season one. Remember that. I'll send you the file once I find it. But then I also considered, and I also want to be made into a brick, please. And, but I didn't go that far. Yeah.
It's a great scene, though. It's like that sort of dirge and the, yeah.
Oh, so good. Yeah. So good.
Question number two, who was the co-writer from Rogue One who created Andor?
Fred Balmsley.
Very close. Tony
really?
Gilroy.
I made that up.
Yeah, I know. Tony Gilroy was the co-writer on Rogue One, and he went on to create Andor. Gonna dive into the show here a little bit. As you recall, you might recall the Imperial Security Bureau meeting, where a member of the council mentions a setback on the Imperial project on Scarif, or Scarif. What is the significance of this planet to Andor's story?
Scarif is where the plans for the Death Star are.
Can I give you that hint?
Is it where the factory is? Where the factory is that they build the parts?
So.
The planet at the end where the plans for the Death Star are?
Yes. So what is the significance of this planet to Andor's story?
Well, that's where Andor dies.
Yes. Pretty significant. So Tristan, you get that one. So yeah, in Rogue One, Scarif is the site of the research facility that houses the Death Star plans, and it's where Cassian meets his fate when the surface is destroyed by the super weapons laser. All right. This one's really obscure, and I feel like it's going to be a hard one. This is the hardest question. Well, actually, these last two questions are the hardest questions. This is pretty obscure, but if you recall, what is at the beginning of the pilot episode, what is the significance of the opening of the pilot episode that features an interesting title card, which notes the year is 5BBY? What does 5BBY mean? And it's, I'll give you a hint. It's a year.
Those aren't Roman numerals.
No. So in the Star Wars universe, events are tracked based on their relation to the original film from 1977, A New Hope.
I know not.
Okay. No, that's fair.
It sounds like a code to crack here.
So 5 would be 5 years, and then the first B is before. The second B is the battle. So it means, BBY means 5BBY is 5 years before the battle of, and this happened in the New Hope, this battle. The battle of, it's the Battle of Yavin. Y-A-V-I-N.
Oh, right. That's right. They mentioned that. The Battle of Yavin.
So that's where, so they're using it like a, like a BCE or, you know, AD type thing. And so the BBY, everything cycles around that Battle of Yavin and in the Star Wars universe in terms of years. And I thought that was kind of interesting. All right.
Cool.
Very cool.
Luthen's Gallery. So Luthen is the head, I guess you could say, of the Resistance, and he's running an art gallery of artifacts. Name. Now, there, you know, this gallery became sort of famous in fandom for all the Easter eggs. There were two Easter eggs from Luthen's Gallery, from the Indiana Jones franchise, and two from the Star Wars prequels. Can anyone name those Easter eggs? There are two from each.
Was one of them one of the stones from the Temple of Doom?
You are correct. Yes.
Ooh. Wow.
There is a number of carbonite blocks within the gallery, and one has the idol from the beginning of the Raiders of the Lost Ark. There are two of them side by side, but they're completely identical to the one that Indiana Jones risked his life for and almost gets crushed by a boulder retrieving. From the prequels are Padme Amidala's got a headpiece in there, and there's a Gungan shield from the Phantom Menace in there as well.
Whoa.
And there's some other cool stuff, but you kind of like, it gets super, like there's a couple items from like one of the Star Wars franchise video games, and then one from a couple of other, you know, franchise, you know, like from the Clone Wars and stuff like that. So kind of cool. Kevin, you win.
No,
you got great. Two. We'll give you the same color stones. You get the bragging rights as the Andor expert in our next show, and we hope you guys tune in for it.
Thanks for joining us yet again. Please leave us a review, rate us, let us know how we're doing. We want to hear from you next week, film and television. Join us for that one. Thanks for joining us today. Until next time.